Good morning. Be seated, please. Justice Resnick is not able to be with us this morning, but she has read the brief. She'll listen to your arguments on tape, and she will be participating in the decisions in the cases we argue. The first case is 98-1970, State of Ohio versus Raymond Tibbetts. Mr. Aubin.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Moore, your justices. Your Honor, myself and Mr. Perkins will be arguing today for the appellant, Mr. Tibbetts. I will be arguing one of the issues, and Mr. Perkins will be arguing some of the other issues, and of course we'll answer whatever questions the Court has. The facts of this case are relatively straightforward. Fred Hicks, Judith Crawford, the victims in this case, they lived with Mr. Tibbetts in Cincinnati, Ohio. On the evening of November 5th, 1997, a surveillance videotape showed Mr. Hicks' automobile driving away from their home. The next morning, Mr. Hicks' sister came over to visit him. She was concerned. She couldn't get anybody to answer the door. Couldn't get anyone to answer the telephone. She went inside, and I think it's important for the Court, and the reason why I'm getting into the details of this, I think it's important for the Court to understand, I know you've seen the pictures, or you will, exactly what she saw, exactly what the police saw. And she saw her brother, Fred Hicks, who was sitting in a wheelchair, he had four knives in him. There were three knives on the floor with the blade bent, almost at a 90-degree angle. She, of course, understandably, immediately ran from the house, called the police. The police came to the scene. Investigation showed that Judith Crawford, Mr. Tibbetts' wife, was upstairs in the bedroom, dead. She had been bludgeoned to death and stabbed to death. But also, it's important to hear, she had a knife still stuck in her hand. Earlier that night, on the night of the 5th, the white Geo automobile, driven by, at that time, Mr. Tibbetts, broke down in Covington, Kentucky. The Covington police confiscated the automobile. They let Mr. Tibbetts go. Subsequently, police investigations indicated Mr. Tibbetts may very well be the person who committed these crimes, and they indicted him. He was subsequently found at St. Elizabeth's Hospital on the psychiatric ward. And he was removed from the psychiatric ward on a warrant, not for aggravated murder, or aggravated robbery. He was removed for a warrant for receiving stolen property. Regrettably, little, or at least not as much as I would have liked to have seen, was introduced at that phase. A psychiatric nurse had testified, she testified later, but basically he had admitted himself. Now, evidence that was developed through the trial indicated that he had been in there in September of 97 with the diagnosis of schizophrenia because he was hearing voices. Interestingly enough, some of these voices were telling him to kill himself. But that was in September of 97. In November of 97, he had admitted himself, but the only evidence was he admitted himself, he had a possible history of psychosis, and that he was subsequently removed from the psych hospital because he was on a voluntary admission. And frankly, if he was on an involuntary admission, he would have been removed, taken to Kenton County Jail. Now, there he was interviewed, not by the Kenton County Police for receiving stolen property. He was interviewed by the City of Cincinnati Homicide for a receiving stolen property, arguably. However, as the Court is now aware, since you've read the briefs, it was, what are you doing with the car? Oh, and now let's talk about, when was the last time you saw your wife? How'd you get a cut on your hand?
Was there any testimony admitted that
none of the hospital records were admitted. The nurse did talk later, and she had said...
You say later, what phase?
In the mitigation phase, she had later said that he was a drug seeker. Whatever a drug seeker is, and I gotta tell you, I thought I was as familiar with the terminology as anyone. I've never heard the term drug seeker before. Evidently, what the prosecution is arguing, somebody who goes out of their way to get psychotropic medications and use them. But I've never heard that.
Which is
directly controverted. Well, strike that. Basically, Yes, that was the content that she was using, that she, he was the person who received drugs, which to my mind would have led someone to believe there was a malingerer, which is directly contradicted by all the rest of the history, which we'll address in one second, his history. But nevertheless, it's out there, and it's sitting there right now. So he, in September, was at St. Elizabeth's in Northern Kentucky for a psychiatric illness.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
I'm lost. Where are you going with this? What proposition of law are you talking about?
Well, those are basically the facts. What I'm arguing is ineffective assistance counsel. And normally I hate to argue this issue, but in this case I believe it's warranted, and that's where we're going right now. Basically, here's the issue, Judge.
So what prop are you?
Justice Pfeiffer, proposition of law number 10, we believe that ineffective assistance counsel occurred in this case, and this for us is the major primary issue in one, not finally, not guilty of reason insanity, and two, not having competency tested. And I'll tell you why we are arguing that. Basically, in this case, there is one defense which would have been viable as to whether he did it, whether he has viable defense, and that is this one. Okay? I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but basically that is it. There is one defense, and that is this. If you don't have this defense, if you don't assert this defense, you have no other defenses in this case. Because, unfortunately, there's blood on him, which belongs to Mr. Hicks. There's blood on Mr. Hicks, which belongs to him. And, more importantly, Mr. Tibbetts does not remember what happened that night. So you're not talking about a case was, I wasn't there, I didn't do it.
And the jury gave him, did not convict with respect to his wife, did they?
No, they did not convict, well, they convicted of murder, they didn't convict of aggravated murder. No, they did not convict, they convicted of murder for Mr. Hicks, Crawford, and aggravated murder for Mr. Hicks.
It gets death because it's a multiple homicide.
That's correct.
So, and there's really no way out of that, even if you quibble about the robbery or the...
Right. The multiple deaths are what is going to trigger this. Forget about the robbery. I mean, the robbery, the pockets turned out completely robbable. They say he did. But I mean, I guess, in other circumstances, you've got to argue differently. But in this case, you have two dead people. There's no doubt about that. They're not going away.
So
what do you have left?
So your focus is that the only viable defense is not really for a reason.
And the other thing is, no competency testing was done in this case. Now, let's look at the picture here that we're looking at. We've got a guy who's facing the death penalty. He has a psychiatric history, which goes back years. This isn't one of those conversions, oh, I must be mentally ill, today I'm psychotic. He does have a psychiatric history that goes back for years. He's telling everybody, I don't remember what happened that night. I don't remember anything. And the reason why I brought up the crime scene, which you correctly pointed out, what are you looking at here? You've got a guy in a wheelchair with four knives stuck in him. You've got a woman with a knife stuck in her neck. You've got knives bent at a 90-degree angle. Anybody would have thought there's something going on here. There is an issue here, especially with the psychiatric history, as to one, whether he really understood what was going on, and two, whether we have a viable, not guilty of previous insanity defense. And that is when you couple that with the fact you have no other defense to bring forward, this was ineffective not to interject this. You had no other choice. This was clearly ineffective.
But I didn't read it that way. I read that I did this. In effect, I did this, but it was because I was strung out on cocaine and alcohol abuse.
Well, that's what he said in his unsworn statement. All right? But just...
Well, we look at the unsworn statements,
yeah,
too, don't we?
I mean, by then, it's over. By the time you got to the unsworn statement, it's over. I want you to step back, forget about that. It never should have gotten to that point. It never should have gotten to the unsworn statement. This issue should have been resolved way before that.
Well, if we take the position that a trial is a search for the truth, why would we not want to get to that point?
Because at the trial, this man had a history of mental illness, and this defense should have been asserted for him. It should have been asserted for him. I'm not talking about a guy who told his attorney's point. By the way, I wasn't for him. I'm not, so let's try that. I don't have anything else to lose. They had a viable defense. They they could have zealously represented this defense without violating their duties as attorney, not for an frivolous position.
But to have a plea for not guilty by reason of insanity, you really have to show, do you not, that there was a severe mental defect or disease?
And they could have shown that. I think they could have shown his psychiatric history, especially when Dr. Weaver himself, or whatever else problems I had with that doctor in this case, says, oh, and by the way, it's quite possible because of the illness, he could have suffered from blackouts, so he doesn't remember anything. And that's exactly what he was telling people. I don't remember what happened. And they didn't assert it anywhere. Judge, I went through the docket last night because I thought I must have missed it. I'm going to have to get up and tell the court tomorrow. They asked for competency testing. I was wrong. I apologize. I must not have been there. It's not there. I read through every single docket entry. I read through my pleadings in there. They never even asked for competency testing. And you're talking about a man with a long psychiatric history with these facts.
Didn't Dr. Weaver say that he was competent and that he wouldn't qualify for NGRI, or not guilty with the reason of insanity?
My opinion is that they should have. Well, I'll be blunt. Yes, he did say that, and yes, I saw it. And
so should counsel then have.
That doctor saying that with this scene, this illness, and everything else, frankly, I would have asked for another doctor. We're not talking about receiving stolen property here only, but the guy's going to do 18 months tops. We're talking about a death penalty case, and they should have got someone else to check. They should have double-checked. It was too important not to.
So that's the ineffective assistance, that the lawyer did not ask for a second. Yeah. Anyway, Dr. Treen also, the psychologist also, was less specific, but that opinion also was that the defendant was competent, wasn't it? Or there was nothing to indicate that he was not competent.
And they should have asked for that specific thing. And then you couple that, not those reasons, saying there are real issues here. And like I said before, Chief Justice, I never bring up this issue because most of the time I don't think it's warranted. I keep doing it. But in this particular case, it is.
Did the defense ever ask for funds to hire a neuropharmacologist?
No, they didn't. They never asked for any counselor. Never asked. And once again, we get back to that issue, which, frankly, I was going to bring up, because I think the other issues are...
Well, but you do. You do in your first proposition and your third and, I think, fourth propositions.
Mm-hmm.
He was prejudiced by a lack of funds.
Right, that's correct.
And you talk about the pharmacologist.
Right,
you were a pharmacologist. Well, why would you not bring it up then? You argue it in your brief.
Because, I argued in the brief, and I'll answer the question now. They should have asked me. But I really wanted to spend the bulk of my time on issue number 10.
Okay.
But I think, if we were, frankly, this is the issue we're going to lose. I think all these issues are important. This is the issue that I really think is...
Well, if you show ineffective assistance counsel, that means it was tainted from the start.
Right.
And therefore, it would be remanded back for a new trial,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just sentencing and setting aside the death
That's
penalty.
Correct.
You're here not arguing, then, that the death penalty should be set aside. You're arguing that the trial should be set aside.
Mm-hmm. I want this trial set aside. This issue is that important. Now, I'd love to have the death penalty set aside, but I think this is the most important issue right here. This trial was tainted. You have a man with severe mental illness, a man who basically has a history of mental illness. When you look at that crime scene, and this wasn't done, I think it should be set aside. Yes, Justice Fine.
Counsel, what's the general reputation of Dr. Weaver? I'm not aware of it.
He's used a lot in these kind of cases. Would I have used him? No. But he's used a lot in these kind of cases. As far as I know, he's not an expert on forensics. As a matter of fact, we were talking about this outside in different contexts. I would use more of an expert on forensic work.
Forensic wouldn't have given you in pharmacology, would it have?
No, I would have to.
Because the pathology is a separate issue for you.
If I had to pick one of the two, I would pick more of a forensic expert in this case rather than pharmacologist. I want both because the case is that important, but I would have picked the forensic expert. If I had to pick one, he would have been the one I would have picked, and that wouldn't have been Dr. Rubin.
But it sounds to me like the main basis of your argument is that he had blackouts, that he was strung out on this stuff, that he probably had a mental defect, and that was induced by alcohol and
drugs.
I don't think so. I don't think his mental illness...
You think he had mental illness independent of his addiction?
Absolutely, sir. Your Honor, I've almost used up my 15 minutes to...
Counsel, before you sit down, what does the expert need to say in court in order to qualify the defendant to be not guilty of reason?
Well, basically, Your Honor, he'd have to show because of his mental disease, he did not know what he was doing at the time the offense occurred. He did not understand what he was doing was wrong. And you got Katie here. If this man had said, I stabbed them because I was mad at them, I'd have to wonder. If he had said, I stabbed them because God told me to, well, that would be something even better. This man couldn't even say that. This man says, I don't remember what happened.
Okay, but doesn't most of the evidence indicate that his lack of recollection is most probably drug induced rather than due to a mental defect?
I'm not sure. I'd say no. And I was very careful when I brought that up, not to try, as I never would, try to mislead the court. No, I can tell you with good faith looking straight in the eye. No, I honestly believe this is more mental illness than drug abuse. Especially when you see pictures of crime scene in the story. One of the things I didn't bring up, and it really stuck out in my mind as did my co-counsel, when he was on boat after this occurred, and he had a night with him. And when his friend asked him, why do you have that knife with you? He goes, I'm afraid I'd be molested if I didn't have it. And that really stuck out to me as someone who wasn't quite there. And that wasn't there at all. The court has no questions. Me and Mr. Perkins will pick it up.
Thank you, Mr. Aubin.
Mr.
Perkins.
Fight night is involved.
Good morning, Your Honor. I just wanted to touch briefly on some of the evidentiary issues which were also raised in the brief, which I believe are very important. First issue I wanted to address was in the 11th proposition of law regarding hearsay that was admitted in this case. There was testimony from a friend by the name of Betty Hoskins who testified in detail about some statements that were made by Judith Tippett prior to her death. She indicated that she turned the deed over to Ms. Hoskins and said, I want you to guard this. I'm afraid something is going to happen to me. And the person I'm afraid of is Raymond Tippett. There was also testimony from Roseanne Crawford, another friend, where Ms. Tippett had contacted her prior to this incident saying she wanted boxes because she wants that son of a bitch, referring to Raymond Tippett, out of the house. Geraldine Anderson also testified that she had talked to Ms. Tibbetts over the telephone on the evening of her death, and Ms. Tibbetts had told her that, Raymond was trying to make her take something, and no, she didn't want to take whatever Raymond was having her take. These issues are important because I think it clearly, and as it was argued by the prosecutor, go to them trying to show that this whole matter was premeditated by Mr. Tibbetts, that he knew that Judith Tibbetts was going to throw him out of the house and that this was his way of stopping it or staying in the house. And clearly, these do not fall within any of the exceptions of the hearsay rule. They were an out-of-court statement made by someone to prove the truth of the content of these statements. They don't fall within the exception of mental state because as the court has held, you can testify about somebody's mental state, but not their reason why they have that mental state. In other words, someone could testify that I told them I was afraid, but they can't go on and testify that I was afraid because...
Counsel, your client gets the chair for the purposeful killing of more than one individual.
Correct.
So what's required if the jury believes that your client is the perpetrator, what more is required?
Well, they're going to have to prove the prior calculations and design and so forth of this murder, which is exactly what these hearsay statements feed into, because they're saying this wasn't a sporadic situation or something brought on by passion. This is something that was planned by Raymond Tibbetts because he knew well in advance that Judith Divis was going to throw him out of the house because of the problems that she had been having. So that, I believe, is the hearsay is a very important because it feeds directly into the prior calculation and design.
I have two questions about the hearsay, Counselor. The first is that let's accept your argument. For purposes of argument, let's accept your proposition to be true, that in fact it was hearsay. My first question is, eliminating all those hearsay statements, if they are hearsay, would the outcome of the trial have been different? That's the first question. The second question is, why aren't they admissible under 803.3?
Okay. On the first question regarding the whether the outcome would have been different, I believe there certainly is a possibility that the outcome could have been different, because what else was there to show that there was any prior calculation of this offense? There's nobody that witnessed the offense. There's no other evidence regarding statements from Raymond Tibbetts that he had prior calculated this matter.
Well, but as Justice Piper points out, we're talking about two murders.
Correct.
Do we need the prior calculation designed for the two murders? He's the principal perpetrator.
I'm not certain, but I believe that you would.
You either have to have prior calculations designed to be the principal perpetrator, don't you?
I believe so.
Okay.
I could be mistaken on that.
And he's the principal perpetrator.
Correct.
And he's charged with two murders.
Correct.
And there's a specific specification to that, isn't there? Aggravating circumstance? Okay. But I understand your argument. You're saying if you throw out the hearsay statements, there was nothing to tie him into these murders that he had been thinking about them. Right?
Exactly.
All right. Now,
exactly.
What about 803.3?
Which is now, you have to refresh my memory of exactly which.
Evidence Rule 803, the declarant's, what is it, existing state of mind.
Yes.
The sensation that they receive.
For sake of argument, it may be admissible regarding the fact that she was scared at the time of these conversations. That would be her then existing state of mind. However, where they go afoul of that rule is that they put in the reasons why she was afraid, and that goes clearly beyond the rules of that exception. Clearly, she's saying she's afraid because of Raymond Tibbetts, because he's doing crack cocaine again, because she wants that son of a bitch out of the house. That went well beyond the exception of allowing a then existing emotional state. If the testimony would have been presented simply that she was scared, for argument's sake, that might have been admissible, but in this case, it went well beyond it because it pointed the finger saying she's scared because of what Raymond Tibbetts has done or allegedly claiming that he's going to do, or again, he's upstairs doing crack cocaine and I'm scared of it. And that, again, the prosecutor argues in closing argument, brings all this up, and talks about the evidence is overwhelming. She was going to kick him out that night. She was going to throw him out. She was packing his boxes. He was going to leave. He's upstairs using crack cocaine, and that led up to this incident. That goes into the prior calculation and design to why Raymond Tibbetts did it, why this isn't a manslaughter or a crime of passion or something of that nature. And certainly we believe that's why the hearsay issue is important. In addition, in the 12th proposition of law, there was a videotape admitted which shows Fred Hicks's car leaving the area, presumably carrying Mr. Tibbetts in it. Now, the problem with that videotape is it was never authenticated. Detective Frisbee testified that it had been dubbed. Somehow the picture of this vehicle had been enhanced, but he didn't know how it was done. He didn't know what process was used. There was nobody that testified to properly authenticate that videotape. But yet, it was used to connect Raymond Tibbetts to leaving the house that day with the car, which he was later discovered. So certainly that was prejudicial to Mr. Tibbetts. Also, the prosecutor admitted a series of other acts which we believe are inadmissible under 404B. There was testimony that Mr. Tibbetts abused crack cocaine, he abused alcohol, and he left his children and he didn't pay child support. Now, what that had to do with anything, how the fact that he didn't take care of his children was relevant to this offense is beyond me. There was testimony that when he was admitted into St. Elizabeth, he presented them with a false name. Testimony from the nurses at St. Elizabeth was Mr. Alvin discussed, claiming that he was a drug seeker. Clearly, these other acts were admitted to paint Mr. Tibbetts as a drug fiend that didn't care for his children, had absolutely no relevance to the case, but certainly that's going to make it much easier for the jury to find him guilty of these murders by the fact that the man doesn't even love his own children, doesn't even care for them, but they should not have been admitted.
Were any of these objected to?
No, that's the problem is that, well, I believe some of them were, there were certain things that were
none of the hearsay statements were objected to.
Right, and that's why we address it under the ineffective assistance of counsel also, that these all should have been objected to and should not have been admitted, but nonetheless they were. And when you combine all these things which were not objected to, which were improperly put in front of the jury, with the issue that Mr. Alvin argued, there's some serious problems with the whole case looking at it in total. And I believe I'm out of time. Anybody have any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Perkins.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, Justices. Phil Cummings on behalf of the State of Ohio. Unless this court has any direct questions for me right now, I'd like to respond to some of the issues that have already been discussed. Let me backtrack, I guess, initially. As far as the hearsay issues go, is the State's position that these, in almost totally, but at the very least in large part, were admissible issues under 8033, the hearsay exception which allows state-of-mind evidence. As this court found in State, Mr. Panovich. A lot of these comments did perhaps go beyond just a statement of the fear that Judy Crawford felt about Mr. Tibbetts. At times, it might have varied from just that statement, which is traditionally seen to be the admissible part of the 8033 exception. But the evidence in this case was so overwhelming that those types of errors, if they even occurred, were not outcome determinative at all. If we took away all that hearsay evidence, the evidence still showed that Mr. Tibbetts was found with Mr. Hicks' car within an hour or so after the murders would have occurred. He had the blood of both victims on his clothing. He was unable to explain these facts. And in fact, his entire defense never really was, I didn't do these murders. It was always, I just don't remember.
Are you willing to concede that the statements themselves do go a bit beyond their traditional 8033 admissions?
I think one or two of them do go into more detail than this tradition.
Then the other thing, sir, is what about, it's funny though, when you start reading parts of the record, the other things, certain things stick out to you in the case that bother you more. The child support thing bothered me a lot. Why would that even be relevant to any of this? And that's clearly, to me, that's prejudicial, because somebody that doesn't support their children don't deserve any consideration. Now, that's pretty strong, but that's how I feel. And that's, maybe the jury felt that way.
I understand your concern. I do think, though, that particular item is very similar to the other act evidence that was elicited. And it at all cannot be prejudicial to Mr. Tibbetts for this reason. All of this other act stuff, including the child support, the career issue, the cocaine use, the alcohol use, the drug-seeking tendencies that he has, it all dovetailed beautifully with their defense in this case, which was that he was just so stoned and out of it because he's a drug addict and an alcoholic, that if he did these things, he couldn't have acted with purpose. So all that evidence dovetailed with their best defense in this case. And I think the child support marriage issue, in a way, actually helps him make that point as well. I was so out of it, I was so selfishly indulging my own needs for substances that I ignored my wives, I ignored my children, and I had this child support problem.
So that was part of their dispense strategy. They introduced child support, you didn't?
No, it was listed by the state.
Sure.
I'm just saying, as far as the prejudicial aspect of that type of evidence goes, I don't think it's certainly not personal.
You mean you were trying to help him?
Not at all.
Oh,
I, I shouldn't say that at all. I'm just trying to diminish any prejudice that might be perceived from that. I do think that the other act evidence really, it didn't hurt him to help him, because all of this is really being complained about is about the drug substance abuse problem he has. And I would like to touch briefly on the NGRI and the competency issue. I just don't think Mr. Tibbetts can demonstrate an effective assistance of counsel when his own expert evaluates him and finds that these defenses are just not available to him. His own attorneys pursued this. They, on the record, said, we want to get Mr. Weaver, we want him to look at the NGRI, we want him to look at these issues. That is in the record. Now, they subsequently did not file for these, and I think it's because, as Dr. Weaver testified, these were just not going to be available to him under the circumstances. And there's one other thing I'd like to point out to the court. The record actually supports Dr. Weaver's evaluation. Mr. Tibbetts himself called his first common law wife after he committed the murders, and he says, forgive me for what I've done. Mr. Tibbetts himself says in his testimony that he was afraid he was pulled over by the Kentucky policeman because he was afraid that he might be patted down and that the policeman might find his illegal drugs, et cetera, et cetera. What this shows to me is, when I submit to the court, that this is a man who understands the wrongfulness of conduct, who understands what the law requires and what it doesn't. And that's why we have him asking forgiveness of his common law life. That's why we have him being nervous in Kentucky within an hour of the murder, because he knows that he could be charged with DUI at that point. So my point is, this is a man to whom the defense of NGRI is not available, because for that defense, he would have to show that he does not appreciate the criminality of his conduct. And all the evidence in the record shows just the opposite, that he did understand right from wrong. And I would like to make one more point as far as the defense put forward by the defense counsel in this case. They did the only thing they could do with this in light of their expert's opinion. They requested and they got instruction on intoxication. This contrasts with a similar case this court decided in a death penalty case, State versus Jeffrey Hill. In that case, the man was also claiming that he committed the murder of his mother in a cocaine-induced blackout. The defense counsel in that case did not request a voluntary intoxication instruction. In this case, that was done. That was pursued. That was the centerpiece of the defense. That's all they had available to them, and they did vigorously pursue it. So it's the state's claim that you really cannot find an effective assistance from counsel.
That was the theory of the defense, was it? Not as the you just said it. Stupid.
Yes.
You didn't know what it was doing.
That's correct. And on that basis, they requested the court an intoxication instruction, and they got it. And they argued that. And that was basically the centerpiece of their defense.
Was NGRI ever advanced, or is there anything on the record indicating that there was at least an attempt to pursue that with additional experts?
Yes, early on in the transcript in the pretrial motions, there's a discussion where the defense is requesting funds for the appointment of Mr. Weaver, and they say we want him to look at the NGRI issue. Your Honor, that's one of the things we want to employ Mr. Weaver to do. And the court said, we agree with you. I agree with you. I'll grant you the funds to employ Mr. Weaver. I'll grant you the funds to employ Mr. Grace. And that's the last we hear of it. And it's just never presented at trial. And this is brought up in mitigation. They asked Dr. Weaver, was this available to you in this case? And he says, in my opinion, NGRI would have been inappropriate. A competency evaluation was not successful. He actually testifies that, I evaluated Mr. Tibbetts.
He brought that up on cross.
Correct. Because it was kind of hanging out there. I think everybody wanted to kind of wondered what was going on with that. So it was actually addressed in cross and developed. Why wasn't this pursued? And he said, well, it just wasn't there for this man.
Okay, now let's go back to this matter of hearsay and why or why not is it important. You have two separate bases for the possession of death in this case. Is that right?
Two different specifications, right?
Of course, felony murder.
Yes.
And the felony being?
Aggravated robbery.
Being? Specific?
The theft of the Geo Metro car and the theft of money in the pocket of Mr. Fred Hicks.
Okay. And the direct testimony with respect to money was what?
There was testimony of his sister that said that within a day or two of the murder, she visited his residence and gave him $200 or $300, which he put in his right front pocket. And the evidence in trial was...
His pocket was...
Yes.
Yes. Other than that, you don't have anything on that. So the car is probably your strongest...
Absolutely. The car is the most obvious and strong for the active robber, yes. But also...
And on that, the hearsay evidence doesn't have any real bearing.
Absolutely. It's irrelevant to that.
So the hearsay is important because prior calculation and design is essential to get the death spec on the multiple purposeful killing.
Well, actually, it's not as relevant at first as
can you?
Yes.
If he kills two people purposefully, can you convict him if you don't have prior calculation and design? Can you get him the chair if you don't have prior calculation and design?
No, in this case, this man only got the death penalty on count three, which was the charge of the murder of Fred Hicks,
right,
prior calculation and design. So a lot of the hearsay that's being complained of goes to Sue Crawford's fear of him and her fear of him as regards to her murder.
I thought he got death on two specs.
He got death on two specs. He got death on the... Well, there were two specifications in count three. He was found guilty of both of those specs.
And they were?
They were a course of conduct and a course of killing was the first. And the second one was committing the offense while fleeing an aggravated robbery. And he was found guilty of both of those specs on count three,
First was what again?
Count three?
Yeah.
Count three charged the purposeful and prior calculated murder of Fred Hicks. That was the aggravated murder charge under A of the statute. The purposeful and prior calculated killing of Fred Hicks, that was count three. And then to that were appended two specifications, that it was done as a course of conduct of killing two or more people, and secondly, that it was done while fleeing an aggravated robbery.
But how do you get the two or more people if one of them is not with prior calculation and design?
It's just massive.
Do you have prior you don't have prior calculation and design on his wife, do you?
Yes, we do account. No, we don't. I think that's true. And they acquitted her. They found her guilty of murder vis-a-vis her. So with her, I think that they found that he was guilty of capital murder on her case under count two in the course of an aggravated robbery. But they did not give him the death penalty on her murder. They sentenced him to life in prison without parole. But we did have to prove prior calculation and design for the killing of Fred Hicks. And the reason the record supports that is there was a difference between the two killings. The killing of his wife was one of passion, as testified to by the coroner. It was a vicious, emotional, passionate attack that one would do in rage towards somebody they knew well and had strong feelings for against.
Well, Hicks appeared to be, if you look at what he looked like when he was found, he looked like the same situation, didn't he, though?
They both looked terrible.
Knives.
Yeah, they both looked terribly gruesome, but I'm deferring to the people that had experts in this field who testified. They said that the coroner testified that the manner of killing the pigs was not one of emotion or passion as much as just a more of an efficient type of killing. And from that, it was argued that his killing was more of a calculated one to eliminate the witness to the emotional, passionate killing that occurred upstairs. So that's the theory the state proceeded upon that showed that this was more of a calculated killing of Fred Hicks because it was done more so just to eliminate witnesses. In fact, Ray Timmons himself said in his testimony that Fred Hicks was a great guy, I liked him, and he really doesn't have an enemy in the world. I mean, this is the kind of man Fred Hicks was. So I think implicit in that is just even kind of an admission that this killing was not one brought upon by passion, emotion, or provocation, but one that was done totally calculated, like one that was done to eliminate witness, and I think that's what supports the guilty.
Mr. Cummins, we've struggled with the issue of alcoholism as a defense in the past, and we've had some pretty interesting arguments among ourselves with regard to that issue. And I think the majority has consistently come down and said it is not a defense to this sort of activity. Here, the trial judge gave an instruction at the request of the defense on alcoholism as a defense. Did the state object to that?
No.
And or was it proper?
I think it was proper in the sense that this was the main defense they had. It's the one they developed. It's one which really all the evidence supports the concept that this man is a substance abuser and an alcoholic. And I think in that sense it was fair to give him an opportunity to present that to the jury and let them decide. I also think their decision was proper. I also think that the circumstances of these killings was such that everything this man did, it was indicated to have been done with purpose. I mean, everything he did, he locked the doors on his way out. He made up names when he was questioned by nurses at the hospital. He took deliberate steps to hide his identity.
I want to stick just to the instruction, because if in fact you say the instruction is proper, and if we come to that, and it would be something that I would want to look at if I were involved in writing it, does that not then permit or encourage such instructions in every case where the facts are such? And let me try it a different way. Supposing that he had been found not guilty because the jury felt, yeah, he did this in such a drunken, cocaine-induced stupor that he didn't know what he was doing. Would you have thought the instruction would have been proper then? See, that's the problem we get into.
I understand. The instruction itself, I guess I would support, because I think the man has the right to, if that's his defense, and there's arguably something in there to argue it, I personally would let him argue that.
But haven't we said that that is not a defense to this kind of activity?
Yes, it has been held. In fact, I guess as of last year, it's no longer available at all.
Yes. Now, if that's the case, how do you support it?
I feel uncomfortable supporting it,
I suppose on the basis of fairness.
Essentially, yes. I mean, essentially, it's undisputed in the record that this guy has been a drug addict, an alcoholic, a cocaine abuser, and his day consists daily of getting up and swinging vodka and having Valiums and Percocets and Vicodins. That's the way he starts his day.
Does that excuse murder?
Absolutely not.
But it's all right to have a charge to that effect. See, that's inconsistent to me.
Well, I guess my feeling would be that if you have that kind of evidence before a jury, it's reasonable to allow them to think about it.
Okay.
And I think it's reasonable to allow them to see if the evidence supports the elimination of purpose given that defense. It's just not here for Mr. Tibbetts under the facts, but I personally don't have trouble giving the jury the option to consider that instruction.
Dr. Beaver in this case testified, don't just border call it that, use the impulse disorder, that is, his inability to control his impulses in the brain. Combine that with taking drugs, he lost all of those other impulses. But that evidence was fully presented to the jury. And the jury had the ability to evaluate whether they felt that excuse.
Absolutely.
Did the state present any
testimony? I guess you're right. Yeah, these concepts were definitely presented to the jury. Intoxication, blackouts, associated behavior, all this was there for them to consider, and they rejected it. I think this court will find that a proper decision after it reviews the record. I could approve that. And the court has any questions for which I answer.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you.
Mr. Auburn, you saved a little over 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Justice. May it please the court. There's a couple of things I just wanted to touch base on. One, something that Justice Stratton has spoken about at the end. Dr. Beaver took the stand in cross-examination. He basically said, I don't think there's an obvious insanity defense, and I don't think he's incompetent. So I guess I don't know why even Dr. Weaver was even there, because I don't think he added much. He contradicted himself when he said, quite possibly could suffer from blackouts too. And this goes to Justice Douglas with the instruction on drug abuse, alcoholism, all of those things. It's not so much the instruction as where this case ended up. Basically, what this case ended up being was, please excuse a crack addict alcoholic for murdering two people in cold blood. And that bothers me. It bothers me a lot. Because I think the jury, any jury, is going to sit there, especially when you add in the hearsay evidence about lack of paying child support, and say, well, this guy doesn't deserve any kind of consideration at all. He's a crack addict. He's a drug addict.
Yeah, but in other circumstances, that kind of a charge, without all of the attendant things that you're talking about, could lead to a not guilty finding, couldn't it?
It could.
Haven't we said that's not a proper defense?
And I don't like this defense. I don't like it in this case, that's for sure. If I had a career alcoholic who blacked out, and something happened and blacked out, maybe then. I'd have to really think about it, though. Because you're moving backwards. You're basically, not only are you saying this man murdered two people, you're also saying, you're saying, he's also a crack addict and an alcoholic and everything else. And so, right from the gate, you're saying, not only did my client kill two people, he's also a drunk and a crack abuser too. And jurors...
But if you don't have anything else...
You did have something else. You had something else. And I think if it had been presented differently, you would have had it. In my opinion, when you look at those photographs, you see what happened. It gets back to one of the justices asked a question. No, Justice Moyer. Well, it looked to me like Fred Hicks might have been killed in heat of passion. You look at those photographs, I find it real hard to believe anyone could say that when you leave four knives in a person, that's part of calculation and design. When you have all these knives bent in half on the floor, that's part of calculation and design. If anything, I think it would have been inconsistent. But we don't have that. But we should have.
When you look back over his psychiatric history, he's not really diagnosed with any other serious depression. He just comes close to the edge on a lot of these diagnoses, so he doesn't need the test. Dr. Weaver says, reading from his prior hospitalization notes of the doctor that treated him to now, he says he doesn't really need the test for psychotic. He's close, yes, almost he doesn't need the test. How can you present that defense?
Because you shouldn't have Dr. Weaver on the stand saying that. There would have been one thing if the prosecution said, I'm going to get up an expert who's going to say, you're wrong. He's not psychotic. 1997, September, this man was hearing voices telling him to kill himself. In November of 97, there's people in a horrific murder. We're not talking about two guys knocked off a bank robbery with a gun. And then their own mitigation expert, or their own expert, is getting up and saying, he doesn't mean not guilty for his insanity. He's not incompetent, even though he has blackouts. I can't believe that Weaver was even put on the stand to say this. Why was he?
It's the truth.
Well, the problem is, and it sure is the truth.
Weaver testified for a whole lot for the defense, and he certainly knows how to be an advocate on facts that stand in the defense, and maybe he just simply didn't have the facts.
Well, then.
But
I think he was wrong in this case, and him getting on the stand, being wrong in this case, didn't help, especially as you've all pointed out, what we're left is with not somebody who has a mental illness, but in this particular case, committed a crime, whether he was incompetent, mentally ill. What we have here is a crack addict who went wild, and that's what we're left with, and it shouldn't have been that way.
Counsel, would you help me walk through the elements here, because as I look at this and what the jury did, it strikes me that possibly they pretty well understood the law and threaded the needle. The statute requires prior calculation and design. And could it not be that they reasoned due to the alcohol, drugs that were a habit and appeared to be present when these events occurred, this man just couldn't was capable of prior calculation and design with respect to properties. You come next to Hicks, and there, prior calculation and design is not required because it's felony murder. So they conclude he did purposefully kill him. And then also, when you look at the double murder, it doesn't appear that prior calculation and design is required. It's purposefully killing. So haven't they taken into effect, into account, wouldn't it appear from the verdict that they looked at this and concluded, this guy's just so strung out, we couldn't find that he has any prior calculation and design, but he does purposefully kill both people, one of which involves felony murder, so he gets the chair on that basis. And then if that's what they've done in their verdict, doesn't the hearsay issue with respect to Crawford have very little importance to the outcome?
That's what they decide, then the hearsay issue has very little. If that's what they decide, yes. You draw a prior calculation.
But moving backwards to what they concluded, because they were asked to find death in both cases, and they rejected that.
They still get back to the point. And I know exactly what you're saying there. I agree with you. The point is, it never should have gone that far, because we still get back to what we're level with before, because of the way this case was presented. And because of, as Dr. Justice Lindbergh Stratton points out, because of what Dr. Reed said, what he didn't say. We're left not with a mentally ill person who committed this crime because of mental illness. Mental illness is a big factor. What we're left is what the jury is left with, crack out and murder two people under horrific circumstances. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Alban. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.